Kamala Harris officially accepts the Democratic presidential nomination in a passionate speech before an electrified crowd.
I promise to be a president for all Americans. You can always trust me to put country above party and self.
What was it like to be on the floor of the convention for our reporters covering the event?
I was fighting for a seat even though I had press floor credentials. The nosebleed seats up in the third and fourth tiers were packed. People were sitting in the staircases.
And the historical significance of what it could mean if Americans elect the first female president. Today's Saturday, August 24th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. Addressing a roaring crowd on the final and most anticipated night of the Democratic National Convention, Vice President Kamala Harris officially accepted the nomination to be the party's presidential nominee. Just 1 month after President Joe Biden announced he would not seek re-election. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara reports from the convention in Chicago, Illinois.
Riveting musical performances during the final night of the Democratic National Convention included Pink, a national anthem sung by country group The Chicks.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early?
But Kamala Harris was the star of the night.
On behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth, I accept your nomination to be President of the United States of America.
Harris told her personal life story, connecting it to middle-class voters' experiences.
We are charting a new way forward. Forward to a future with a strong and growing middle class, because we know a strong middle class has always been critical to America's success. And building that middle class will be a defining goal of my presidency.
She highlighted her background as a former prosecutor, in line with her party strategy to contrast against Republican nominee Donald Trump, who has been convicted in court.
Guilty.
Guilty. Guilty.
Like many other speakers, she warned of a document outlining extreme right-wing policies linked to Trump. The former president denies it.
And we know what a second Trump term would look like. It's all laid out in Project 2025, written by his closest advisors, and its sum total is to pull our country back to the past. But America, we are not going back.
Inside the convention, it was all applause. Outside, pro-Palestinian rallies were held every day.
The protests outside have not swayed Harris' position on the war on Gaza. While she called out for more protection and aid for Palestinians, she reaffirmed support for Israel's security. She called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and a pathway towards a two-state solution.
Gaza is the Democrats' one area of disagreement. Out of around 4,700 delegates, 270 signed a petition demanding that the U.S. stop arming Israel. Harris' address to the nation came just a month after President Joe Biden announced he would not seek re-election.
Joe, I am filled with gratitude. Your record is extraordinary, as history will show, and your character is inspiring. And Doug and I love you and Jill and are forever thankful to you both.
As Harris spoke, Trump sought to reclaim attention by visiting the U.S.-Mexico border and hosting a social media event. But nothing dampened the delegates' enthusiasm.
She's setting us up for the future, a future we've been waiting for, a future that really represents everybody in this country. And we are elated that the wicked witch is dying and we're moving forward with a good life.
Kamala explained exactly what's at stake for this country. We're all flying the American flag. We all have USA, and that's for a reason, because this is a fight for this country.
Running mate Tim Walz joined Harris on stage to close out the convention with just 74 days to the election. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Chicago.
C Since emerging as the Democratic candidate after President Joe Biden dropped out, Harris's campaign has broken fundraising records, packed arenas, and turned opinion polls in some battleground states in the Democrats' favor. And that energy seemed to continue right into the convention.
Are you ready?
With speeches from celebrities, friends singing her praises, and even the usually routine roll call of delegates turned into a dance party.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is DJ Cassidy, and I'd like to welcome you all to the Democratic National Convention roll call! Now we're going to pass the mic from state to state.
The proud, great state of Alabama proudly cast 56 votes for the first Black woman president of the United States of America, Kamala Harris, and the next vice president, Tim Walz.
Colorado proudly cast its votes for Kamala Harris. Giddy up!
VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has spent the week covering the convention and joins us from Chicago.
You were there. You've been to every one of these conventions since 2012. What was different?
Well, I would say that what was different was the amount of interest, the attendance. I was fighting for a seat in the United Center last night, even though I had press floor credentials. The nosebleed seats up in the third and fourth tiers were packed. People were sitting in the staircases. It was just everybody wanted to be here because they knew it was the moment for Kamala Harris, for this campaign, to see if she can beat Donald Trump.
And the whole week seemed to really just have an energy that we haven't seen in a lot of these conventions. Would you say that's the case as far as the whole convention in general this week?
Well, yeah, I think we need to take a step back and remember that we've never had a convention where the nominee has only been the candidate for the last 4 weeks. We've never had the sitting president step aside as the nominee. So there are a lot of unknowns, a lot of firsts here, and people just really wanted to see if the Democratic Party could pull it off. You know, a Joe Biden convention is very different in tone than a Kamala Harris convention. And they certainly seem to be able to turn on a dime and plan a big entertaining event that also had substance and did the job of introducing Kamala Harris to the American people.
Right. They had so little time to make all those changes, and yet it seemed very well orchestrated.
Yes, by and large, one notable note is that Monday night was certainly running about 90 minutes behind schedule. So unfortunately, President Joe Biden wasn't able to give his kind of farewell speech in prime time for most Americans to see. And by the time we got to his speech, it was very, very late at night on the East Coast and late at night here in Chicago. So after they got over that little speed bump on Monday night, things went very smoothly.
And so many big names, former President Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, you know, so many celebrities. It was quite the spectacle.
It certainly was. You know, it was certainly a packed list of speakers. They had a lot of new campaign videos that they were playing in the convention center for the delegates, telling Kamala Harris's story, telling about times she has gone up against Republicans, against Donald Trump, against difficult people in her time as a prosecutor and attorney general in the state of California. So there was a lot of content for everyone to absorb very quickly in 4 days.
And just a couple weeks prior, you also attended the Republican convention. What do you think the differences were?
Well, interesting thing about the Republican convention is that when that happened, Joe Biden was still the nominee. And the Republican delegates that I spent 4 days with were riding a high. You know, President Trump had just survived an assassination attempt. They felt like they were on the upswing, that they were going to win this election. I felt a lot of energy from them. They were talking about some of the ideas that they wanted to have in a second Trump administration, a return to the America that they want to see. And so there was a lot of energy. But of course, the campaign has changed dramatically since that time. So you can't even really make that comparison anymore.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joining us now from the airport in Chicago. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Anytime.
Still, the real test for the Harris campaign will be in the race against Donald Trump. Speaking to Fox News in a phone interview Friday, the former president says he's doing well this election cycle.
No, she's not having success. I'm having success. I'm doing great with the Hispanic voters. I'm doing great with black men. I'm doing great with women because women want safety. They want safety. And they don't have safety when they have somebody allowing 20 million people into our country, many of them very dangerous people.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Kamala Harris became the first woman of Black and South Asian heritage to become a major party's presidential nominee. And if elected, she would become the first woman in American history to hold the office.
The path that led me here in recent weeks was no doubt unexpected. But I'm no stranger to unlikely journeys. So my mother, our mother, Kamala Harris, had one of her own. And I miss her every day, and especially right now. And I know she's looking down, smiling.
Joining us now for perspective is scholar and historian Ellen Fitzpatrick, professor at the University of New Hampshire and author of the book, The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency.
Do you see Americans ready and more open? We certainly see a stunning turn of events here.
I think that there's kind of a two-part element to this question, and it's an interesting one. Public opinion polls have indicated for decades, really, that most Americans, in excess of 90% and higher now than ever, if asked, say that they would be happy to vote for a woman president. A woman candidate for president if nominated by their party. So in terms of the general, you know, response to is there the opposition that we saw in the 1950s and earlier to even the concept of a woman president? No, that doesn't exist anymore in theory. But it always comes down to the question of which woman are we talking about? And there, too, I think that Hillary Clinton's near win in 2016 made a difference in terms of many Americans, millions of Americans supported her. She won the popular vote. And so that, I think, is an indication that there is every reason to believe that Americans would vote for a woman president. At the same time, it remains a hurdle that no one has gotten over. And until someone does, we won't know for sure. And the other side of it is this candidate, one that Americans, a sufficient number of Americans across the country and factoring in the Electoral College will put in the White House, we don't know. And we won't know until the election is over.
And certainly events that have occurred here in the United States, including Supreme Court decisions on reproductive rights, abortion, have motivated women. I heard a quote the other day from someone that said, I'm voting for Kamala Harris not because she is a woman, but because I'm a woman.
Well, that's a really interesting and important dimension, I think, of the gender question this time around in this election, which is different, in fact. And that is that on the one hand, we have this sort of global question of are Americans ready to elect a woman president? And how important is the question of gender to that? And I would say, thus far, it doesn't really seem all that important. People really aren't focused on the question of whether, you know, are they worried about having a woman be commander in chief? Are they worried about a woman being able to conduct foreign policy? Are they worried about a woman deploying military troops? These kinds of issues that have arisen in the past. And I think Hillary Clinton did put those issues to rest, as did the surge of women's election to political office that took place after Clinton's defeat. So we now see women in positions of authority all over our political system. The second issue, though, where gender does arise, is the question of reproductive rights. And the Dobbs decision has clearly mobilized many Americans who are extremely uncomfortable, to put it mildly, with the recent decision of the Supreme Court striking down Roe v. Wade. So it's an interesting paradox where the old gender question, I think, has sort of been put to rest, at least as far as we can tell. And yet there has been the other issue of reproductive rights, which is being framed more broadly by the Democrats to involve not just women, but families, personal freedom, in a way that seems to be resonating with many voters.
I mean, and could you have imagined 2 months ago that we would even be having this conversation when Joe Biden was still running against Donald Trump and Democrats all but felt like they were doomed, so to speak?
Well, I can imagine that we'd be having the second part of the conversation having to do, because Biden as well was supporting the protection for reproductive rights, and was extremely critical of the Dobbs decision as well. So that part of it, yes, would be the same. But the level of enthusiasm, and here again, I think that in some ways, in imagining over the long history of women running for the presidency, and it is a long history, that the idea that the political moment would be such that the difference in style, right, in temperament and approach would be seen as so refreshing and welcome by so many voters, at least potentially, that is surprising, I think. And that is where you see the importance of the larger historical and political context, that absent the tone of the Trump campaign and the Trump presidency and the tensions that it has created and the response of the Biden administration and citizens over the last several years since 2016, has reframed all of this, I think, in a very dramatic way, and an interesting one.
It's interesting, yes, how, you know, mm-hmm, for decades, women have been putting cracks in this glass ceiling to gradually chip away at it. And then this, almost seemingly overnight, has just reinvigorated a party that it's sort of stunning to watch the way it has changed.
I think it also is very interesting, and I think sort of speaks to an important truth about equality and the struggle to achieve it. And that is that when you remove barriers that are arbitrary and based on old prejudices and open political life and participation to the broad array of diverse citizens, you widen the talent pool. There were important reforms that took place in the Democratic Party after 1968 that has really transformed the party, and changes, of course, in the Republican Party, too. So we're seeing a much wider pool of talent in the Democratic Party. Trump's dominance of the Republican Party makes that not so relevant there right now, that show that, you know, there's a lot of talent out there that we miss out on if we exclude certain groups or people from one background or another, or men versus women, from representing us in political office, and that the country has a lot to gain from a more inclusive political system, really.
Would you say this is also another generation? This generation,
yes,
is made of a different fabric, so to speak. You know, it's just a whole new generation and a whole new way of what they want and what they see for the future.
Yes, it's definitely a different generation. It's the baby boomers, alas, myself among them, are moving towards the exit. I think that this Harris and Walz in particular as a team have the capacity to kind of bridge between the older baby boomers and younger voters who see the world more in terms of the issues that are being embraced. And so, but the World War II generation, my parents' generation, is largely behind us. And they were, of course, the dominant force in American political life from, you know, the post-war period onward.
It would appear that the younger generation, some of them voting for the first time, don't look at it like, oh, like it's a negative for it to be a woman or a black woman or an Asian woman.
They don't have the prejudices of the 1950s and early 60s. And, you know, I'm saying this broadly. Unfortunately, there still is the lamentable reality of prejudice that still exists. But they've grown up in a very different world than even the baby boomers.
And of course, they're also looking at a different future when you think about something like climate change.
Of course, they are. That's absolutely right. And more concerned about it. It's their education, their orientation, their knowledge of these issues, while varied, gives them a different perspective. And I think you're seeing an effort to appeal to them and their concerns in a way that previous candidates in American political history over the last, let's say, 40 years would not have anticipated this.
So how big of a deal and how significant, historically significant, would it be if we do elect the first woman as president of the United States?
I think it will be a very big deal if this ticket is elected. I think that certainly it would be a threshold will have been crossed in terms of having the first woman president. And I think sooner or later that's bound to happen. But I think in terms of the direction of the country and whether this is likely to be an extremely important election, it is going to be. It either will be the restoration of a Trump presidency, which many voters are deeply concerned about in terms of the potential threat to democracy that some Americans see and the direction that the country might go in under another Trump presidency, versus what Harris and Walz are offering, which is a very, very different model of governance and really a different conception of the role of the federal government, one seeking to scale it back further and to centralize executive power, and the other looking to use the powers of the presidency to enhance the social welfare of a broad array of citizens. So it's going to be a very important election either way. And in some ways, gender is the least of it.
I would imagine that if this ticket wins, if Kamala Harris does become the first woman president, then beyond that, it won't be such a novelty.
It won't be a novelty, no. I don't think, nor will it necessarily remove all of the obstacles that have previously existed. There certainly would be a lot of pressure on her, I think. But yes, it would certainly be a milestone, and it's not to be minimized, but I'm really, really struck by the degree to which, in some ways, the fact that she is a woman candidate, although it's bringing, it seems to me, a kind of freshness to this particular race and energizing people and the reproductive rights issue she is poised to and has spoken to, all those things together make gender matter. But in other ways, it's so interesting that this woman candidate is emerging at a moment when, again, her gender seems to be in some ways the least important question at stake.
Yes.
It's a paradox.
Yep.
There's so many other bigger deals, it seems, that people are not so worried about having a woman president, a woman in the White House, as they are about who is best poised to lead the country at this particular, you know, vital moment in its history.
Ellen Fitzpatrick, historian and professor at the University of New Hampshire and author and editor of 8 books, including The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Thank you so much for being with us. And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.